Okay, this is lecture 30. The last time we were together, we were talking about combining constraint situations. Here on the top line, I have the rotation generators, some of the three squares. The rotation generator is less than or equal to 1/2 h bar squared. That makes it less than 3/4 h bar squared, which is the lowest for spin 1/2. So this is equivalent to saying that all the j's are 0. This line is p squared plus q squared less than h bar. That would be the lowest oscillator state. I wanted to combine these two in the same situation. And the natural sum would be to make that h plus 1/2 h bar squared from each of those. But they have different dimensions. And so it turns out to be useful to multiply this family by h bar. That makes that h bar squared. And then this is an actual situation which will do it. That sum is 3/4 h bar squared, which would fit the first excited, the spin 1/2 of this. But if you take all of that for h bar squared, then there's nothing left over for this guy. So he will project onto 0. So that's the zero operator. The only split that works is to give this one the ground state and to give this one the zero state, and then you'll get a non-vanishing projection operator. So the question was about combination, and there is an example which actually seems to work. Question? Yes, question.
The right-hand side is 3/2.
Okay.
And if p squared plus q squared were 1/2, that would leave 1.
Okay, so let's make that 1/4.
Okay.
Okay, so there's a, thank you, correction. We were in the middle of our first class constraint situation. We had discussed our projection operator, E, which was going to commute with the Hamiltonian. That led us to believe that we could live with the initial value equation, that is to say, to project initially onto the physical subspace, and then the dynamics would maintain that evolution into the physical subspace. We had not yet discussed how we were going to make the projection operator E. It's supposed to be deal with a compact Lie group, such as our SO3 or SU2 or SU3 or SU28 or something like that. Then there is a invariant group measure. We'll call that dxc. We integrate over the group itself, written in so-called canonical coordinates, where the phi alpha are the Hermitian chosen here, Hermitian generators. Xc alpha, e to the minus ixc alpha, phi alpha would be the elements of the group. And I integrate that with a normalized form for the group invariant measure. Since it's a compact Lie group, it has finite group volume, and I can get a normalized form. it's an elementary exercise to show that this operator E squared equals E adjoint. Therefore, it is indeed a projection operator, and it has the following additional properties: that when I act on it with an arbitrary group element, that would come in and give me the multiplication of this group element with the internal group element. I write that as tau dot xc alpha, phi alpha, dxc. But this measure is invariant under left and indeed under right translations as well. So all I have to do is make a change of integration variables, tau inverse dot xc here, and this is an invariant measure, so that makes it the same as DXC, same group integration, which is again E. In other words, E to the I tau alpha phi alpha acting on E gives me E again, which means I am living on the subspace where all the phi alphas are identically zero, that subspace of the Hilbert space, which is consistent with the Dirac point of view on H physical. Okay, so that's one way to make the E. Let's see how we can put that to use for us. I want to take the let's start again with the path integral formulation, pj qj dot minus Hamiltonian dt dp dq. This will be the propagator between p prime q prime and the initials and p double prime q double prime at the final. I want to impose the initial value condition, that is to say project on the initial situation. I will do that, at least symbolically, by saying that there is the classical form of the constraints, and I integrate over the coordinate values at the end values here, so I'm integrating dp prime dq prime over 2 pi by h bar, and I integrate over the group as well. So we have this, if you will, extra integration over the group parameters and over the final coordinates. That has the virtue, then, of inserting into the conventional propagator formula our E inside. That's one way to do it. Let's see how that can be remarkably useful for us. Suppose I take the point of view that I must start with the full family of Lagrange multipliers. So I put in the lambda alpha of t from 0 to capital T as customary, phi alpha p and q dt, integrate dp dq, and I will do this extra integration itself, just as we had before, imposing E at the beginning of the calculation. What am I calculating here? I'm calculating the coherent state propagator not solely of the Hamiltonian by itself integrated from 0 to capital T, but I have the Lagrange multipliers lambda alpha of T times the constraint operators dt acting on the protection operator p prime q prime then for our final k. Now we haven't talked about it too much in the context of the course. In fact, I can't quite remember having talked about it at all. Maybe I did. But we're dealing now with a time-ordered product here. This is not an ordinary integral. If that symbol wasn't there, then that would mean I would have to do this integral up in the exponent to get the operator by itself and then put it up in the exponent. The time-ordered expression, I'll explain to you in a second what it really means by when we go into a lattice form for this. So what would that lattice form look like? I would have my initial bra. I would finally take the limit as epsilon went to 0 or n went to infinity. And here is the definition of what that would look like. Well, here's an H bar, by the way. I'm going to introduce epsilon, this time not only as T divided by N plus 1, but I'm going to put the H bar inside of it so as I don't have to continue writing it. So that's epsilon times H plus lambda alpha N plus 1, and let's call it N rather, phi alpha. That's small time step epsilon, and the Hamiltonian, which is time independent, the final value at the time step N of the lambdas times the phi alphas. Then in a separate exponent, H plus lambda alpha N minus 1 phi alpha. End of bracket, product of those all the way down to the initial situation, H plus lambda alpha 1 phi alpha with our projection operator E waiting for us at the end, and then P prime, Q prime. I want to disentangle this. I want to take all the H's out and bring them to the left. All the phi's, I want to move to the right. This I can do because I've already made the hypothesis that the commutator of phi alpha with H stays in the family of the phi's. So there's a phi beta. Phi beta. Too bad I don't have a kappa right after that. It would be a nice, useful thing. With an I up here. So that the Hamiltonian acts on the phi alphas and keeps it in the family of the phi's. A simpler way to come to the same answer. The answer will be the same, I assure you. But it would be more direct for you to see. If I simply study the subcase of all of that by saying that the Hamiltonian commutes with the phi's directly. If the Hamiltonian commutes with the phi's, then I can move all the H's separately out of the phi's by themselves. And that means I would have e to the minus I t capital script H divided by H bar from the Hamiltonian terms. Then I could collect all of these lambdas. They wouldn't commute with themselves, but they would be some combination of the capital phi, because these are group elements and these are individual elements of the group themselves. So there would be some combination of the taus, some combination here, which depended on the original lambdas, divided by H bar if you like, acting on the final projection operator P prime Q. And we've already seen over here a consequence that if I take e to the minus I tau alpha phi alpha, a group element acting on E, I will still get E itself. So this term disappears completely from the problem. I get the original propagator, projection operator, P prime, Q prime, and the whole answer is totally independent of the family of the Lagrange multipliers. That is something which is not true in the classical theory, but it is a wonderful property of the quantum theory, which is made self-evident in this particular formulation. Let's do a simple example to show you how this business happens. Our example will correspond to the following classical problem. The classical action is PQ dot, so we only have one P and one Q, minus P squared over 2 for our Hamiltonian, minus lambda, P minus 1, dt. Vary the P, and we get the following equation of motion. Q dot equals P plus lambda. Vary the Q, and we get P dot equals 0. Vary the Lagrange multiplier, and we get p equals 1. So what do we find? We find that p should equal, p dot should equal 0, p is equal to 1, so q dot is equal to 1 plus lambda. Lambda is undetermined, first class system. Q is any function we like. And of course, to pick a particular q, then we will have to pick a particular lambda. What about the quantum theory for this particular problem? We start with m e to the I integral pq dot minus p squared over 2 minus lambda p minus 1 dt. And let me, at the same time as discussing this example, introduce the idea not only of imposing our projection operator in this particular fashion, but let me propose to suggest that it could be done by another way. Let us integrate over the lambdas with a weight function c, which is normalized, dc lambda equals 1. We know we can already do that right away because that's an example of that, with the property that at least one projection operator E is introduced by this integration. By integration over lambda. Now, the original prescription, say, of Fadeyev, this D was D lambda itself, a flat kind of measure, Lebesgue-like, without the C here, if you will. And that introduced the delta functional of p minus 1. That's not what I want to do. I want to introduce the quantum constraint, as we have been talking about. What would that look like in our case, again? This is a good example of my basic tenet for the whole course, is you never integrate, you don't even know the answer. The answer is given by e to the minus I Hamiltonian t divided by h bar. Our Hamiltonian is cap p squared over 2. So why don't we write that? P squared over 2 h bar cap t. Projection operator, p prime q prime. Whether I have put in 6 projection operators or 1 by this C, it's equivalent to 1 because e to the 6 is still unity. And this particular projection operator, E, which is always defined in the same way, p minus 1 quantity squared less than or equal to delta squared, will commute with the Hamiltonian. Okay. Now, what does that actually look like? Let's go to the p representation according to the Fourier transform of Schrödinger, and that would look like p double q double, I'll use the symbol k for that, diagonalization, e to the minus I k squared cap t divided by 2h bar. I'll tell you what the e does in a moment. And then we have k p prime q prime dk integration. If that integration ran from plus to minus infinity, that would say the projection operator is equivalent to unity. But I'm going to put in the restriction that the projection operator tells me. It says to integrate between 1 minus delta and 1 plus delta, which are the limits of the k integration. Let's recall what the functional form of these matrix elements would look like. Then that would become 1 over square root of pi, integral 1 minus delta to 1 plus delta, e to the minus k minus p double prime squared over 2 plus I k q double prime minus q prime minus I k squared over 2 times capital T. Oh, I'm setting h bar equal to 1, I guess, for this part of the calculation. E to the minus k minus p prime squared over 2 dk. I want to do this integral for delta very small. This is not an easy integral to do, but I'm going to do it approximately. So let's assume that delta is a number positive, but extremely small. I'd like to joke with people that we'll think delta is 10 to the minus 1,000. Really quite small. Okay, so from a practical point of view, it says that k is basically 1. So I will do that in certain places. I have e to the minus 1 minus p double prime squared divided by 2. Same for the other part, 1 minus p prime squared over 2. Minus I, I'll put a unity here, t over 2, so that's my energy Hamiltonian contribution. And then I have left over here, I take the 1 part out of this. So that's e to the I, k is basically 1, so that's q double prime minus q prime. And then what I have left is an integral, e to the I, now I can do my kappa, q double prime minus q prime d kappa between plus and minus delta, plus a correction term, order delta squared. This integral we can directly do. It gives me 1 over root pi. E to the minus 1 minus p double prime squared over 2 plus I q double prime minus q prime minus I t divided by 2 minus 1 minus p prime squared over 2. And then that integral, all I have to do is recognize that this is a symmetric integral. The cosine part will survive, the sine part will not. So cosine, integral cosine is sine. So I get a sine, kappa becomes delta, q double prime minus q prime, divided by q double prime minus q prime. Plus order. In fact, there's a factor 2, because from 0 to delta, it will give me 1 sine. And then, of course, order delta squared. Now, if delta is equal to my 10 to the minus 1,000, then the second term over here is 10 to the minus 2,000 of order. And from a decimal point of view, this is 1,000 units further to the right than all of these terms. No computer, presumably in this building, Eric, you can correct me, would be able to sense this term at all. Therefore, from a practical point of view, and trust me, this is actually the correct, this is an adequate answer to it. From a practical point of view. I remind you of an analogous system in the physics world. Suppose I have electrons in a two-dimensional plane, electrons running around a magnetic field, and that makes the Landau levels, and so I have energy levels that look like this. I want to concentrate on the lowest Landau level. How do I do that? I want to separate the Landau levels, we've talked about this before, by making the magnetic field very, very large. So this distance is h bar omega. I make that B field very, very strong. But I also have to go to low temperatures so that there's no possibility that things in this level will extend significantly to the next level. And indeed, by making B sufficiently large, going to sufficiently low temperatures,
I can, for all practical purposes, treat this as a single level system. Well, I argue the same way, that in a, if I plot the kappa coordinate here, and this is delta and minus delta, that's like a sharp well here, an infinite square well, where I think, well, I should put my bars outside, where things are confined for kappa to live in this little well, there is a ground state here, if you will, with a certain energy, which I could subtract off and call that zero energy. But then the next level of energy would be enormously higher. And from a practical point of view, for such kind of deltas, you would never observe it. Okay. My critiques say, my people who criticize my work would say, but we want it to be truly zero. So I say, all right, let's go to the limit. And we're going to go to the limit delta equals zero. Well, if we're not careful, we'll lose everything, right? Because sine of zero will be zero, and this term will disappear. So I have to use my magnifying glass, which means I divide by two delta to begin with, square root pi e to the minus, and all those terms we had before. Q double prime minus Q prime minus I T by 2. It's too bad it's not T for 2, but it's not. 1 minus P prime squared over 2 sine delta Q double prime minus Q prime over Q double prime minus Q prime. And now, with the 2 up here, now I let delta go to 0. I warned you before, one of the previous lectures, about doing this too casually, because I showed you a function which was zero at the origins. We called it psi of x and y, and it got too large at the origin. But we're dealing with the coherent states, which are smooth functions. So this limit has no difficulty in existing. That 2 delta will cancel with this delta, and the limit that delta goes to zero, all of these terms disappear, and I get simply 1 over square root of pi e to the minus 1 minus p double prime squared over 2 plus I q double prime e to the minus I t over 2 e to the minus I q prime minus 1 minus p prime squared over 2. There's no more remnant of the q variables. The only q variables that appear are here and here, but none of it over here in a complicated way. This problem factorizes into a product of problems depending on P prime alone and P double prime alone. So this is a one-dimensional Hilbert space. Whereas, even at this point, before we took the limit, we're dealing with an infinite-dimensional Hilbert space. So this kind of limiting behavior will change, in general, the structure of your Hilbert space and has done for us down here. Let's remember what the coherent states look like. It was e to the minus q times capital P, e to the I little p times capital Q times our particular vector, eta perhaps we call it, or O we call it. These were coherent states. How much of that remains in our presentation? We have a simple phase factor, e to the minus I q prime. And that becomes because we have replaced the operator P by the number 1. That was our true representation of the constraint itself. P minus 1 is now exact. And when P equals 1, then e to the minus iq is the only q dependence that we can expect for that vector, and conversely in for complex conjugate for the other vector. So at this level, we have finally enforced the constraint. There is no other Q dependence left in the problem at all. And notice that in the coherent state world, when we say P equals 1, we still have P dependence in the arguments here, P prime and P double prime, because the P is a C number having nothing to do with eigenvalue of a operator and is a simple multiplier of the Q operator. Nothing bad has happened to the Q operator in this business. The P stands there just as it wants to. The clear message of the functional form here is that capital P has been now represented by the identity.
Okay.
Question. Do we still have this, those properties in the coherent states that when you put P between two coherent states, you get that, you get little P?
So the question is, do we still have the property that PQ expectation value in the coherent states? I believe this is your question. The operator capital P should be little p.
Yes.
Well, no, we don't, because we are dealing with a projection operator in here now. And this projection operator made out of the p's will commute with the projection operator. Let's put it in twice. So we are living in a situation where this expectation value should be unit, no longer p.
P has been forced to be unity. So that's the story of the first class systems. But in my judgment, the beautiful properties of this approach to constraints by means of the projection operator comes from its application to the second class systems, for which traditional methods have a major amount of difficulty. So let's talk about the general constraint situation. In particular, we're going to be talking then where second class systems are allowed, where neither the original Dirac prescription nor the original Fadet prescription had much to say. In the classical theory, and I'm drawing the constraint hypersurface here in my phase space, if I put myself on the initial constraint equal to all the constraints equal to zero surface, and then evolve forward in time, I will typically leave the surface. And therefore, I must use the particular value of the Lagrange multipliers as a force to restore me to the surface itself. Again, I propagate forward in time a little bit, but no, I will leave the surface, so the particular value of the Lagrange multipliers is chosen to bring me back to the surface. You remember that it's characteristic of the second class systems that the family of Lagrange multipliers are determined. Indeed, they were determined to ensure that the dynamical equation for the constraints was preserved, that you stayed on the constraint hypersurface. That's the general situation. It's only the rare case, indeed the first class systems, in which the dynamics is so nice to you that once you are on the constraint hypersurface, you will stay on the constraint hypersurface. What does that tell us how we should formulate our propagator in the quantum theory? By analogy, it says we should start first on the physical Hilbert space, propagate a little bit forward in time, minus I epsilon h, where epsilon again is the number of time steps divided by the total, wrong way, number of the total amount of time divided by the number of time steps, and for convenience, we'll put the h bar in there as well. I've propagated forward, but probably I have left the physical Hilbert space. So I project back again onto the physical Hilbert space. Propagate another step forward in time, probably left it again, go back again. E to the minus I epsilon h, etc. Repeat that many times until I come to a final step of that particular kind. Then I take the limit of this as epsilon goes to zero, equivalently n goes to infinity, such that the product is the right amount of time. There's a theorem which says the limit of such an expression is given by e to the minus I
projection operator E acting on H from both sides times the amount of time T divided by H bar, again with the projection operator. Okay, that looks good. That's the kind of expression we would like. Live in the physical Hilbert space, propagate forward with a Hamiltonian which lives entirely in the physical Hilbert space, and for fun at the end, you stay in the Hilbert space. This one's not necessary, but it's a nice symmetric formula. There's a little trouble with this. H will be permission, let me just do it loosely, permission. If that's the case, then our restricted Hamiltonian will also be Hermitian. But Hermitian is not enough to guarantee that you generate unitary operators. Our original Hamiltonian, we have always decided, should even be a little bit more than Hermitian. It should be self-adjoint. Furthermore, we would like our Hamiltonian, say, to be bounded below. Most examples are of that type. I will admit, I was going to say that the Coulomb problem is not bounded below. It's not bounded below classically, but quantum mechanically it is actually bounded. So I look at this operator here. I know it's Hermitian. And I know this will be bounded below as well, because this is acting on a subspace merely of the original Hilbert space. And there is a theorem which says that if I have a Hermitian operator with a lower bound here, then there always exists a self-adjoint extension. All that means is that, yes, this will generate unitary transformations, but it may generate more than one, and you have to make a choice, something else you have to add to the problem to decide. Let's assume, for simplicity, that there's only one of these, that is to say that EHE is what's called essentially self-adjoint, meaning it will generate a unique unitary transformation. Unitary evolution or transformation. Okay, with that assumption, with all these possible problems understood, with that assumption, then this will be a unitary evolution within our physical subspace. Very good. I want to use the coherent states, once again, to bring this evolution formula here and here into a usable half integral formulation. I'm going to do that in two different steps. So we'll be interested then in this ultimate goal. How do we represent this? And as I say, we'll give two different answers to that problem. Probably only one of them today. Let us take our formula with all the E's and everything over there and put a resolution of unity in between at the end of these E's. Now, one E is the same as two E's. One E is an E squared. So for fun, I can make that an E squared here, and you won't know the difference. And so I can put an E on both sides of this quantity. etc. Of course, that will entail some integrations. The last one of these is P prime, Q prime. There's going to be some integration of L equals 1 to capital N, dPL, dQL, over 2 pi h bar. I make that a little bit cleaner in this line, product L equals 1 to, L equals 0, rather, to capital N, PL plus 1, QL plus 1, E, E to my psi, epsilon H, E, PL, QL. That takes care of all the terms of that type, and then what we have left over is the product L equals 1 to capital N of the individual integrations.
Okay.
So, this is exact. It's true for any number of n. I'm now going to make an approximation. I'm going to assume epsilon is small. I will therefore expand this. I will make an error in that expansion. So to correct that error, I must take the limit epsilon to 0 as we normally do. So I will write equal lim epsilon to 0 n plus 1 n to infinity epsilon times n plus 1 equals capital T, and I suppose I have to have my h bar involved in here somewhere. Good heavens.
No, you stuck the h bar in the epsilon, you know.
I know, but now I'm going to multiply it by it because that will cancel it.
Okay.
So now I have this expression, PL plus 1, QL plus 1, E, 1 minus I epsilon H, again, projection operator E, PL, QL, and our product over our many integration variables. In a way, this is the best form to do these things. We can stretch it out one more time. We can say lim epsilon to 0, n to infinity. If I just expand that out, oh no, there should have been a product in front of that. Sorry, L equals 0 to capital N. So here's the product L equals 0 to capital N. And now I say PL plus 1, QL plus 1, one projector operator, PL, QL, minus I epsilon, PL plus 1, QL plus 1, projector, Hamiltonian, projector, PL, QL. End of those expressions. Product over the integration variables, L equals 1 to capital N, dPL, dQL, 2 pi h bar. Okay, this is also the best form we could do. When I say best, I mean this is as good as it gets from the point of view of an expression which you might be able to bring to a computer and get some numbers. Well, we're not going to be content there. We're going to try to bring it into our standard form. We were in a situation like this before where we were able to bring this upstairs and do things upstairs when we took our formal interchange, but that depended on the fact that we were dealing with unit vectors. That construction demanded that our coherent states were involved, and those coherent states had a length, which was unit. Now that's no longer the case necessarily. The E, and this could be an E squared, so an E here and an E here, this vector may no longer be a unit vector. Can't be bigger, could be smaller.
Let me introduce then the notation PLQL with two arrows as the notation of E acting on the coherent state, and then divided by the magnitude of that vector, which will then make that a unit vector. So this is a unit vector now. If I do that, then this expression now becomes limit epsilon to 0, n to infinity, etc., product L, well, okay, I have to leave a little space. So I'm going to put a little space, put something there in a moment. Product L equals 1, 0, rather, to capital N, double arrow, PL plus 1, QL plus 1, PL, QL, double arrow, minus I, epsilon, double arrow, PL plus 1, QL plus 1, H, PL, comma, QL, double arrow, end of expression, product L equals 1 to infinity, space, dPL, dQL, 2 pi H bar. I have divided by this normalization, and now I must multiply it, I must restore it. Here it is divided out to make normalized vectors. Here I must put it back in. Each vector PL, QL in the middle will come in twice with an E in front of it and an E in back of it. This then expression is being replaced by PL, QL, double arrow, PL, QL. So I get the length of that vector twice. That is to say, I get E, PL, QL, length squared. But the square of a vector is nothing but the overlap of the vector. The square of the length of a vector is nothing but the overlap of the vector with itself. So that is E, E, PL, QL, or PL, QL, single E, because E squared equals E, PL, QL. That restores the normalization that I had to take away to make these unit vectors. And there were two vectors at each time to do that. The only place there was not two vectors was the very first vector, P double prime, and the very last vector, P prime, Q prime. So I need two factors in front of here, M prime and M, where M double prime is the length of the original vector, P double prime, Q double prime, now with an E there. M prime is the length of the other vector, P prime, Q prime. So that's the length of the beginning vector, that's the length of the ending vector.
Is your product there at the end to infinity or to end?
Oh, no, goodness gracious. Thank you so much. Capital N. Okay, so this is our arrived at expression. We have now arranged for these guys to be unit vectors inside. We're now in position to write the form this takes for continuous and differentiable paths, and we will do that the next time we get together.